Osiris.
Fucking right here. Pull over.
I mean, the only way for me not to move is to, like, for Ryder not to have the mic
so
at
what
all.
You're saying is we need to get Ryder a microphone.
No.
We need a third mic. So that's cool, Darwin. Just come on in, man. It's fine. I tried to set the chair up so that the dog can actually come through.
Nice job, man. Thanks for giving me a little hideaway.
Yeah.
No, he's like, I'm being good, see?
We brought him a bed out here.
I'm right in the middle of everything.
Yes, you are. Thanks, Apple. I'm really glad
you
that
we
have your mic situation all settled. Wow, Mel.
Here,
what
I want.
Wow, what? Wow, wow, what? Wow, wow.
God damn it, man.
Are we on yet?
Yeah.
You're not close enough.
Yeah, get closer, bro.
Can you eat the mic itself? If you can actually bite the mic.
All right, we're good now. Hey now. No Simple Road family, welcome back to another fun-filled, glorious episode with Aaron and Melanie and Apple and Ryder.
Hello.
Say hi, everybody.
Hi, everybody.
I knew you guys were going to say hi, everybody.
You told us to say it, duh. Yeah,
but you could just... all right. Anyway. What?
Why are you...
No, I'm
Aaron,
only saying
Aaron's
hi
Aaron's acting for the camera
Joe.
Right now, and there's no
there's
camera.
There's no camera.
And I'm not saying hi to everybody, just to Joe.
Who's Joe?
And then
Joe Mama.
Oh, God, dude.
Oh, sorry.
What about Joe? Joe Papa.
Joe Ball-headed Granny.
Wow. All right, so as soon as we hit record, the wind starts blowing. There hasn't been a single gust today. As soon as I hit record, the trees
it's
come to
the
life.
The world saying hello to the rest of the world through the podcast.
It's joining us.
Hey now, No Simple Road family. That's what Mother Earth is saying. With her blowy self.
Yeah. Welcome to the world.
So this week's episode is Jason Louv, author, magician, and this is really cool, guys. Being into magic is something that has been a part of my life for, well, since I was a teenager. But it's not something I talk about all the time, and here on the show, it's been alluded to in the past a few times, and those people that know me would kind of know the inside of what I was talking about, but in this episode, it all comes out, and...
Are you talking about dressing up like Harry Potter?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, when I wear a tuxedo and pull the rabbit out of my hat and all that. You've seen it.
Yeah.
It's Friday night.
It's magical.
Yeah.
Although you have been using the same... rabbit since you were 15, and we're really concerned.
Well, it's fine. I thought you're supposed to change him.
Yeah,
he's not fine.
That's gross.
He's not fine.
Okay, that's weird. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'll get a kitten.
There we. That
pull
would
a kitten
be,
out of my hat.
That would actually be really cute.
That would be
I'm
cute.
Down for that.
I'll say it's a rabbit, and then pull out a kitten
and be like, "Oh, oops."
Yep. Okay, so that's not that kind of magic. But I'm not going to get into it because you guys will hear about what we're talking about here in the interview. Jason, the book that just came out, John Dee and the Empire of Angels, actually a couple days after it went on sale, it actually went on to the New York Times bestseller list, like right away.
And I've been seeing all the people with his book. That's really cool.
Yeah, it is really cool. And he's got such a soothing, cool voice,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. So, but the business.
And he said a lot of really amazing things in this interview. And I really can't wait for it to come out because it's... Well, I guess it's coming out right now.
Well, in a minute.
In a minute.
There's a lot to learn here.
But anyway, I just want to say personally thanks to Jason because you just kind of brought a lot of things to life just by talking. And Aaron's right, your voice is kind of magical also. And it was just a really great interview and getting to know you on air. And I'm really glad that you got that bestsellers what is it?
Title?
I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you call that?
Well, it just got on the bestseller list.
There you go.
I guess.
Got on the bestseller list. Let me hit the microphone. Sorry.
Well, that's all I'm going to say. Thanks, Jason,
that's
for being
all
on
have
the
to
show.
Say about that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, wherever you guys are at, I know that the weather's weird out there in the world right now, but I'll tell you what. I think it's safe to say, I'm going to say it.
Don't you?
I'm going to say it. Spring has finally sprung in Portland.
Yeah.
If there's snow next week, it's 100% your fault.
Yeah, well, I'm fine with that either way.
Did you see the post that Justin Lacey posted? Snowing in North Carolina?
In April. That's cool. That's normal. Nothing to see here. Move along. Watch TV. Shut up. It's fine.
Go pet the penguins in North Carolina.
Yeah. Polar bear.
Or tune into the podcast and listen to Jason Louvre talk about his rad book and magic.
Yeah. Do that. I like that idea better, Mel. Mm-hmm. Tune into the podcast. Oh, so yeah, business stuff.
Business.
First things first. So I'm asking a favor, guys. We're family, and family from time to time asks things of each other. And one of the things I'm asking you to do is leave us a review, a 5-star review. Yeah, that whole thing. So on Apple Podcast, I read a whole article this past week about, like, nobody really knows what the algorithm with Apple Podcast is. They're very close to the vest with how shows get rated and all that and get out there. But one of the things that is super important, actually the most important, is the review system on there. So if you're listening to us on an Apple device or through iTunes or Apple Podcasts, pause the show, search the show in the app that you're listening to us on, and leave us a 5-star review. You don't have to leave text. You can. That's great. We love that. I love reading those. But just the 5-star alone.
Just hit that 5-star.
Yep, boom. And then come back and hit play and continue on. I'll tell you, that's the way that more people are going to find out about the show. And it gets us up in the rankings. And it's important for the show. So we're family and we do stuff for each other.
More people have been listening to the show.
Dude, it's been crazy lately.
You guys, seriously, we sat. I don't know if it was yesterday or the night before. But Aaron was like reading us all of the text that was coming in from the number that we've been posting on Instagram. And there is some really fun and cool shit that you guys are, you know, talking about and just being silly, which that's fun. You guys are talking about some serious shit, which that's always cool. And I'm grateful just to hear that stuff. Like, it is like kind of like one of our Friday night things. We all get together after our long, busy week and just talk about, like, Aaron's like, all right, guys, I'm going to read some stuff. And it's just like such a fun thing to hear. And I don't know. That's all I got to say about that.
Well, let me see if I can find a couple.
He's trying to find it. He wants me to stall, but I don't really have
stall,
too much
Mel,
to say.
Keep talking. Keep going.
Maybe Apple.
You don't have much to say.
Not right now.
There's not right now.
So, hey, NSR family. I'm Tim from North Carolina. Recently jumped on and joined the NSR family last month. And
wait,
yeah, you did.
Wait a minute. But I wanted to talk about that really quick.
Didn't have nothing else to say, huh?
Well, you gave me a little bit of fuel.
Now she got something to say.
No. Like, I thought about that line like all night, Tim, like just recently joined the NSR family. Like that says a lot. And I am really grateful because I know I've said before that we are a family. And then if you feel like that title applies to you, then you are. That's all. That's the requirement. So, Tim, thank you so much for saying that. Thank you so much for feeling that. And here's the rest of Tim's letter.
Yeah. So, I forgot. Oh, joined the NSR family last month. Loving the podcast. I just saw Dark Star Orchestra in Raleigh with my girl, and my face was melted. I've been into the Dead for a few years, but that was my first live experience. I'm hooked, and I'm going on tour this summer and seeing Raleigh, Saratoga, Hartford, city shows, and Darien. Maybe even Ohio. Anyway, guys, love you. Peace out. We love you too, man. And that's super cool that you wrote that in. And
it's super cool that you're going on all those shows, man. You're
going
to have a blast.
Lucky. I wish
you
I could do
that. You
and your
girl are going to have a blast.
Hey, just discovered the podcast and I'm loving it. Really dig the stories and commentary about the overall culture and experience of the Dead. You put the vibes into the words. I do that like this. I go, that's the vibes into the words. Seeing the Dead for the first time this summer, as well as the Terrapin Family Band. Super stoked. So when you go see the Terrapin Family Band, your mind is going to explode because they're amazing. So yeah, that's just a couple of the messages that we got. And you guys can call into that number, and the number is on our Instagram. So follow us on Instagram at No Simple Road. And then also the website, nosimpleroad.com. We've got some small shirts and one extra large left. So if you're a small, come on by and grab a shirt. And we got stickers up there. And we're working on some other stuff for you guys in the merch thing. Also on there is the family tab, and on there is the newsletter. You can throw your email in there and sign up for the newsletter and find out about what's coming up on the show and any new developments. And once in a while, I send out a little personal message to all you guys. I ask your opinion about stuff. So that's a way for you to get more involved with the show and find out about the inner workings and doings of No Simple Road. And then also the Patreon. So, guys, we have had some amazing people sign up for our Patreon over the past few months, and we appreciate it more than you guys can imagine. Every person that signs up is a step closer to being able to do this thing full time, and that really does mean the world to me and the rest of the family here at
Patreon,
No Simple Road.
Don't you mean something else?
No, I mean Patreon. What do you mean?
Our secret code.
Oh, Chandonator. Yeah.
Chandonator.
All you Chandonators out there. Come on. You guys know what I mean. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
As much.
Always will be as much as you can. Yes. Chandonator, guys. You know, here's the thing. I put the goal up there, $500 a month. When we get to $500 a month, we're going to do a live Q&A with just the Patreon subscribers, and you guys will actually be the episode for that week for No Simple Road. If you want to be on, you will have your voice on there. If you just want to write in, we'll read the questions and answer them. So, yeah, help us get there, you guys. Together, we can pull it off, and it'll be rad. And, you know, I know that, like, it's weird to make that digital exchange, but it's the way that this thing works, and it's how this...
It's not that weird these days anymore. It really isn't.
No?
People pay for a lot of things that they don't see anymore.
What do you mean?
I mean exactly that. Like, you go on any website, you go on Amazon, and you're looking at a picture of what you're paying for, and you have no problem paying for it, or you buy a song that you're never going to literally have, but you can hear it. So people are paying for it, or they donate things or whatever. Their money is leaving, escaping their hands, and not necessarily getting any material thing back in exchange. So... what we're not even asking, but what we're saying is put your money where you are enjoying it.
Put your money where your love is, baby.
We do spend money. Like, I don't spend a lot of money on it, but I spend probably $5 to $10 a month on hints for word games.
Do you really,
it's so,
dude?
Yeah, because it's so easy. See? To just push the button. And like, okay, I'm stuck on this word. I'll pay the 99 cents for
I pay for hints. For money in my iCloud for more
space.
More space. I never I see
pay,
that.
And I think everybody listening probably pays for Netflix.
I pay $5 a month to... channel on YouTube.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I want them to be able to make cool stuff.
So, yeah, help us keep being able to make cool stuff. You know, it's funny, and this may sound self-serving, but whatever, it's fine. I actually listen to our show.
I listen to our show every week.
And I like it.
Yeah.
It's
I donate
fun.
To it. All that change in there, when I get my tips, I throw it in there all the time.
So
I donate to our show, too.
Even $1 a month, guys, like that... That's energetically the same thing as $1,000 a month to us. It's all wonderful, and every one of those things is at one step closer. And that's how it just, someday you wake up and you're there.
You know what it reminds me of? Like, if you go to your mom's house and you don't live with her anymore, but you like brought orange juice and like a French bread so that, you know, you can have that with the breakfast. And that's kind of like what it is. Like, you guys are like providing, even if it's like $1 a month. That's why I say $1 is cute, because yeah, it's not gonna like pay our hosting, but if a bunch of people did that, then a bunch of people did pay for our hosting. So that's kind of how I see it. Like, it's no small thing. It's everything is like, everything's appreciated.
Chandonator.
Yeah. Always will be as much
always will be as much as you can. So yeah, and that's that. We're going to be working on getting some other really cool stuff going here over the next couple of months, and I'll just say it again, the summer concert thing is in full swing. Sweetwater 420's going on. I know that Inside Out with Turner and Seth were out there at Sweetwater 420 doing some on-site interviews and had games and all that rad shit. And if you guys haven't checked out that show, they're really cool and they're on our network with us, so you guys should go check them out. And also Fear of a Craft Beer Planet, I checked them out over the last week, and those guys are really fun, man. There's no script, and those guys just go, and they're fucking funny, and that show's a blast. So yeah, go check them out. So that's the whole business side of this podcasting world that we're in. And all you Patreon people out there, just know that we appreciate every month when that thing goes into our account, and we're able to pay for our hosting and we're able to do what we do means the world to us. And thank you guys. And those of you that are on the fence and out there listening to me babble right now and going, you know, I should do that. Just do it, man. Because you're helping a brother out.
James.
And a sister. And two other brothers.
Felicia.
Carl.
Tyler.
Myrtle. Danny.
Susan.
Bill.
We're talking to you.
Yeah. All right, guys. So, yeah. Anyway, Jason Louvre, guys. This is a magical interview. I'll just say that. And get prepared. Get a notepad. And if you haven't checked out his book, you should check it out.
John D.
and the Empire of Angels. And also...
The links and all that stuff.
All that stuff. The links will be in the show notes and on the website to his personal website. Because he has, like, courses, an entire course on magic at his personal website. And then also, he's got a website just for the book. So I'll have links to that stuff up in the show notes and on our website. And there's another book that he wrote that's really made an impact on me personally is The Psychic Bible. And if you listen to this interview and you're so inclined, you should pick that up too, man. That book is alive and will reach into your life and change stuff for the better. So yeah, anyway, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, my cold and I present Jason Louvre. Doesn't take you 35 minutes to poop.
I know. I would say.
I'm sure you sound great right now since you're going to lean forward the whole time.
Uh-huh.
We're recording.
Well, I didn't know that.
Uh-huh. That's,
you do,
that
you
was,
do like to sneak
that
record
was my
on
point
us.
Earlier.
I can tell because his voice
well, yeah.
changes.
That was my point. Because normally I talk like this, and then as soon as the mic comes on, I'm like, hey, how's it going?
It's really a breath of fresh air when we re-record. I get real sick of that voice.
What?
Yeah,
what's wrong with that?
I can't handle... No.
Whatever. All right, let's do this. Jason is waiting. And...
Hello.
Jason.
What's up?
How you doing, man?
How you doing?
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So,
how's my sound?
You sound awesome.
Great.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can hear all of us okay?
Yeah, definitely. Do I have echo or feedback or anything like that? Do I need to do headphones?
No, you sound perfect.
Great. Okay.
That was easy.
Nice.
Well, you know what? Wait. Now that I said that. Okay, maybe not. I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Were you getting echo?
A little.
I've done this. I've used this setup for other podcasts. It should have been. It's been fine. So.
Yeah, we're good.
Okay.
So first thing I'll do is introduce everybody that's here because there's four of us. It's not just me.
Okay.
Melanie is my wife. She's here.
Jason, what's going on?
Hey, Melanie, how's it going?
It's actually going really good.
Nice.
And then across from me is Apple.
Hey, Jason. Welcome to the
Apple.
Show.
And we got Ryder over there, too.
Did you almost forget my name?
No.
Hi, how's it going? Right.
I think his name is Ryder anyway.
And that's Aaron's nephew.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, all of you, for spending your Sunday with me and having me on the show.
Yeah, man. We were really, really, really looking forward to it. We're honored, too, brother. It's really cool. So a little bit of, history of us. Like, this show has pretty much just been... us sharing our experience of being alive and what it means to be in the world with people. And we've had some really amazing guests on the show. We've had, you know, musicians and artists, and you're actually the first author that we've had on. So you get the distinction of that cool thing.
Honored again.
Yeah.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah. Right on. And, you know, so for me, like growing up, I'm about 10 years older than you, I think. And,
okay.
I had some older brothers growing up that were into psychic TV and Coil and Throbbing Gristle and that whole scene. And when I started coming into my adolescence, like, I got into the Grateful Dead thing.
Okay.
And, so my lens was really different than my brothers, but there was always this, like, I don't know how you would put it really, like, influence, and like I was always really interested in what was going on in that corner of the room, you know what I mean?
But
sure.
But the dead thing was way more approachable to me and didn't have the shock value.
You know, we had a lot more kind of positive community value as well, and it's a bigger group also, so a lot more people to meet.
Yeah, yeah, and the point of entry just was it. I don't know. It just seemed, in hindsight, was just so much simpler, and I just wonder, like, because I'm reading the Psychic Bible right now.
Okay.
And what it, because you have such a history with that, like, in your opinion, what's the reason for the shock value? What's the thing?
So are we recording?
Yeah.
Already? Or
yeah, go okay. For it. Yeah, we're just hanging out. That's basically cool. All we okay. Do.
Well, yeah, so I guess just to introduce myself a little bit. So yeah, my name is Jason Louv. I'm an author and a journalist and a teacher sometimes online. And one of the things I've been interested in for the last 20 years is the idea of magic and shamanism and the alteration of consciousness through every single possible avenue I could get my hands on, you know, whether that was different spiritual traditions or psychedelics or the occult tradition. And so, so I've kind of been all over the map, but right. Certainly, you know, my primary mentor in my early 20s and mid 20s was Genesis Peoridge, who you know, founded Throbbing Gristle and Psychic TV. And Jen obviously has been at the center of the Western occult revival and in the 70s, late 70s, and then throughout the 80s, and then into the 90s, and certainly into now. But definitely at that time period was instrumental in bringing the idea of the occult kind of out of hiding, where it had really been the province of, you know, a very small number of people, mostly in the UK, who were much more kind of academic in their approach, you know, centered around secret societies. And it was still a very, very underground thing. I mean, obviously, this was before the internet, and it was also before the beginning of kind of the zine era, right. Which they were right there for. And so what they were really doing was using the platform of music and then zine culture and kind of, you know, similar, you know, creating these kind of countercultural or otherwise cultural networks outside of the mainstream, very similar to the Grateful Dead,
right?
To, you know, very successfully communicate these ideas that had been hidden from the public and often saved for an elite. This is something that makes a lot more sense, by the way, if you have context of the British occult world, and having spent a lot of time over there, you really get a sense of how occultism has really been baked into English culture for a long time, and it's kind of, you know, very common. It's done behind closed doors. In many cases, it had been a pursuit of the elite and even the upper classes. And so, what Jen was really doing was kind of being a bull in a china shop and just trying to almost destroy this elitist culture and get the information out to the public. And I think that the shock value of a lot of those TG performances and Coom Transmissions performances and early Psychic TV performances, and obviously that carried on into Coil, was just shocking people out of their daily trance and trying to get them to pay attention.
Oh, okay.
And that's something that, for instance, Gurdjieff, the great Armenian Sufi mystic from the early part of the 20th century, was very fond of and talked about. He talked about giving people a shock to wake them up out of their robotic trance, you know, because most people are in a trance all day long. They're just, you know, at work or, at, you know, in their car or tuned out in front of the TV.
Right.
And one of the real ideas with magic is shaking people and reminding them that they're alive. And so people like Gurdjieff and then, of course, Crowley very much pioneer the idea of using, you know, kind of confrontational tactics that we later associate with maybe punk rock And certainly industrial music really, really took that idea on. Yeah. I don't know how relevant it is anymore, to be quite honest with you, because of the internet, and we're constantly being shocked by, you know, we're living in the age of Trump now. It's
nothing, you know, shocking anymore.
Yeah. Right. Nothing, you know, it's, I think it's actually much, and I think Jen would certainly agree, and in many cases really has impressed this idea on me, that it's much more important now to be present and compassionate and loving with people, and just be human, you know, and spend time with people and show them that they matter. I think that right now is much more shocking than, I don't know, you know, some crazy performance art thing.
Yeah.
Because that's what people aren't getting. They're very, so much disconnected and atomized and just on the internet, on their phones.
And from somebody like me that, you know, I know just a tidbit about that whole world, and then excuse me, like coming into it and reading about Psychic TV and the Temple of Psychic Youth and what she did and all that, like the outside, the shell of the thing is this shocking, scary thing, and then once you peer behind that, it's these things that you're talking about of acceptance and love and compassion and helping people and just wanting to get the information out there.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever seen those Tibetan paintings of the wrathful deities? They look like these gods that, you know, have a 20 arms and 15 heads,
Dakini,
and they look like they're on fire.
Like that, yeah.
Yeah, certainly. And have a Dakini consort or you know, Vajrayogini, or it's focused on the Dakini, things like this. Many times, gods appear wrathful, and I don't just mean this just in the context of Psychic TV, but
right.
I think that certainly in the site, you know, people who have had, you know, pretty intense psychedelic experiences will probably understand what I'm talking about here, where very often things can appear very wrathful and shocking when they're trying to get our attention, but then when we see through them and we relax and see to the other side, it's just emptiness and compassion.
That's the trick, though, is getting people to the point to relax, right? I mean, like, you're talking about that shock value, and like, for me, my frame of reference to that is walking into my first Grateful Dead show on acid and being shocked out of myself, and then finding out what was behind it and what was inside, and it was this whole different thing than what it appeared to be on the outside. And that's what drew me to it, was that there was layers.
Totally. Well, yeah, let's talk about the psychedelic experience, because, you know, obviously my background is in magic and the occult and that kind of way of looking at things, which has been a very, very misunderstood tradition for a long time, in some cases, and that's its own fault, because magic is very often applied shock tactics, like we've been talking about, and,
right,
you know, or even, you know, some people use satanic imagery and things like that. Certainly Crowley did. And in many ways, magic has kind of played itself in that sense, because people took it seriously.
Right.
And but let's talk about magic, right? So I'm sure that I'm guessing that probably most of your listeners have a familiarity with the psychedelic experience.
Oh, you know, yeah,
to some extent. So if you understand psychedelics, then you really understand magical consciousness. I mean, when you're on psychedelics, particularly when you're at a you know, like a high, you know, like a peak, you're in a peak state, you're in a high, almost like ritualized environment, like I much imagine a Grateful Dead show,
right,
must be like, or Burning Man is like, or even just sitting in your room in the dark can be like, but, you know, in an intentional environment where you're on psychedelics for the reason of evolving yourself, not just because you took mushrooms and went to Astro World, as Bill Hicks put it, you know. But when you're doing them intentionally with kind of wanting to evolve or wanting to have a spiritual experience, for lack of a better word, that's the grounds from which something that we might call magic kind of naturally emerges. And so, you know, with the psychedelic experience, you know, if it's a closed eye experience, you can have all kinds of visions and meet all kinds of beings and, you know, see things that you had no context for. Like, how is this in my head? You know, how am I seeing things that look like they're from old fairy tale books or whatever it might happen to be? Or if you're doing it open-eyed in a group environment, you know, you can be having all kinds of synchronicities happening. Yeah. Or, you know, or like maybe somebody has a conversation with you while you're tripping and it has like, you know, profound resonance and it seems to be like have much deeper meaning or almost like it seems can seem like there's almost a divine level to it. If you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So magic is really a language for negotiating and navigating that state. You know, it's a roadmap and a set of techniques for, I would say, getting into that state, and there's also techniques for getting into it without substances, with yoga, for instance, and lots of other techniques. And then it's a way of approaching those experiences so that you have a shamanic toolkit for navigating them, and you kind of know what to do while you're there, and you can contextualize the beings you meet or the things that happen to you and navigate with the tools of a shaman. I hope that is kind of makes magic a bit more clear.
So Jason, what would be the need for that? Why do we need the toolkit for that world or that, you know, that space?
Well, I mean, there's a ton of reasons, right? I mean, we've all met people who have gone into psychedelic states and been unable to manage it and unable to contextualize it and have had to have trip sitting or have had to, you know, have been unable to reintegrate that experience back into their life. Right. And that usually doesn't go, you know, and then either they shut down and go back to being completely normal, but a bit traumatized, or, you know, or they just can't manage it at all and it becomes disastrous for them. So I think that's the most direct use of it is, helping people to navigate those spaces and contextualize them in a way that they can understand them, put them in proper context, and reintegrate them back into their lives. And I think that was always the role of the shaman, one of the roles of the shaman in tribal cultures. But certainly, I think that we need those skills because obviously people in the West, in my perspective, know that they're missing something. They know that they don't have souls.
Right. Right.
Let's be direct, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And since the end of World War II, I mean, I think when we went through World War II, we kind of took that as far as it could go.
Yeah.
And realized how awful and horrible and that we could not go back there. Right. And since then, I think that, and since the spiritual repression of the 50s was kind of broken by the baby boomers, and then the 60s happened and on from there, I think that we've now had a couple generations starting from the baby boomers and going on from there where, you know, not just Western people, but certainly people all over the world have been much more interested in spirituality and shamanism and opening up and trying to understand themselves and find themselves. And a lot of the, as somebody who has spent a lot of time in my adult life, studying with and hanging out with, you know, people who might be considered masters of other traditions from other cultures, whether that's Sufism or, the Hindu cultures or Nepali shamanism, and seeing these things in context, as well as the Western occult tradition, you really get a sense of the people who have been doing this type of thing for a long time. They're like scientists. They're almost like computer programmers. They have a very, very set and regimented way of approaching these things to get proper to get the right results. And that's
Jason,
a very different.
What are they programming?
Well, that's the question, right? If you're well, no, I don't say that with a there's no undercurrent
okay,
with
okay.
that. because the second part of that is, you know, obviously, yes, you could say, well, they're programming people to do what they say or whatever, but no.
No, I don't mean it in that sense, but I just, you know, like on the bigger scale.
Well, the idea with magic is that you take control of your own programming.
Okay.
And once you learn the techniques, then you can program your own reality. But people aren't there yet. I mean, if you go to a concert, for instance, or if you go to a political rally, whatever it is, you are being programmed. You know, that ritual experience has been set up to program you with a very specific ideology, and you know, in a sense, whoever created that is acting as the shaman. So I'm much more interested in people learning the tools themselves so that they can program, they can deprogram themselves from mass trances, whatever those happen to be, and reprogram their own reality and take control of their own destiny. And I think that learning the techniques of magic is an excellent way to do that. But to finish my point, what I was going to say is that in the West, most of the people who are currently seeking spiritual experiences, right, whether that's through tribal type experiences or you know, yoga or psychedelics, particularly with psychedelics, where people just kind of assume that you just take it and something's supposed to happen.
Right.
They are like, you know, little children. And I don't mean that pejoratively, but in the sense that where the West has tremendous technical capability, like we're able to create almost anything in the physical world, all the way down to now nanotechnology and CRISPR, the internet and all
this.
CRISPR, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right? That's like the level of our ability to manipulate the material world. But when it comes to the spiritual world, we're still in preschool, and you really get a sense of that talking to people in other cultures. You know, they really do see us as developmentally challenged, quite frank.
You know, for me, like, taking psychedelics at first in my adolescence, it broke me as a person. Like, what you're talking about, I didn't know how to integrate those experiences. I didn't know how to communicate anymore, and luckily I had these older people that I looked up to that were into magic, and I knew, like, instinctively something inside of me said, this is where you can figure out how to put yourself back together again. But it wasn't a cut and dry thing. It wasn't simple. That road is not, you know, not fraught without its craziness and instability and ego and all the bullshit that comes along with, you know, when you get into something and figure out that there's power there and there's a way for you to work in this awakened state, I guess, for lack of a better term. But it showed me that there was a way to put myself back together, and that there was somebody else had gone before me and figured it out. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And I certainly had the same experience. And that really is kind of the shaman's path in a way. You know, the shaman is devoured by spirits and then must put themselves back together again. And you see that myth and that story repeating throughout world cultures, whether it's Tibetan Buddhism or Egyptian mythology or Hinduism. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the ego and things like that, I mean, I'm certainly trying to do everything that I can to simplify it for people and remove the ego. And that's why I've been, and that has been a problem in the past. And that's one of the things that Jen was trying to break through, and, that, you know, I'm currently, you know, that's why I'm teaching these courses at magic.me, where I'm presenting all this material in as simplified and straightforward and non-obfuscated a way as possible, to just give people the information without, you know, any commitment other than just watching videos on the internet. So
right.
I think that's really important to do right now.
So would you say that magic is something that's for everybody?
No. Well, okay, I have two answers to that. The first is that magic in the sense of remembering that you are in control of your life, and understanding that you are shaping it with your decisions and the language that you use and even your body postures on a day-to-day basis, and remembering that you and not anyone else is in control and that your decisions can and must shape your reality. Yes, I think that that is for everybody. Now, to get into the, you know, the immensely technical overhead of something like the Western magical tradition and Kabbalah and ceremonial magic, or let alone all these other things like esoteric yoga and Sufism. No, I don't think that's certainly not for everybody. Just because it's such a time commitment, it becomes like a career. Like, you know, it, for me, it really has been like training to become a doctor. I mean, it's been my full-time existence for the last 2 decades. And so it, clearly it's tricky to do that and maintain all of your other, you know, a career or anything else. So the specialist role, no, that's not for everyone, but it doesn't, it shouldn't be, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, not everyone needs to become a doctor. You know, it's just important that there are doctors there that you can go to if you need to. That's what I would say.
That's a great.
Well, thanks for being a spiritual doctor out there, man. Justin. Well, we appreciate that for sure, because there's a lot of questions and spiritual things that you don't even know who to ask. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do, and that's it's a kind of a problem in this culture, and I think it's a I think it's you know, people should have that. They should be able to just have someone to ask. But also, I think that it's an issue in a deeper sense because, you know, as our culture develops more and more powerful weapons of mass destruction, I mean, starting with the atomic bomb to now we've got, I mean, you mentioned CRISPR, you know, the potential of bioweapons, the potential of nanotechnology, and now the coming destructive potential possibly of an AI or multiple AIs.
Right.
You know, I think that Western culture has the ability to destroy the planet almost infinite times over, yet the spiritual and moral level of development of, you know, an adolescent, let's say, you know, and that's a dangerous combination.
Wow. Yeah. But on the flip side of that, wouldn't we also have the ability then in Western culture to elevate consciousness on the same level that we would be able to destroy? Isn't the impetus there?
Well, that's my hope, right? You know, that's what I'm hoping to encourage, and what you're trying to encourage with your podcast, and one of the great things about the internet and the ability of people to, you know, do their own videos and podcasts and things like that is that these things can be expressed, and people can not just express them but connect and talk about these ideas and share community over them, and have other people, you know, or anyone who's listening to this as part of this community, you know. Right. And that hadn't been really possible before. No. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why people use shock tactics before, to just break through the media deadlock, to get, you know, one of the reasons that Crowley is so remembered, for instance, Aleister Crowley, was that he was able to manipulate the media by saying, "Well, I'm the devil." You know, yeah. So that they wrote all these kind of yellow journalism articles about him. I mean, but to be fair, he kind of was the devil, but
yeah. You know, he was a bit off. Yeah. A little bit off,
but he really, was able to manipulate the media in that way. And that has kind of been, I don't know, people like Anton LaVey have done that and things like that. And it kind of becomes this kind of Marilyn Manson dead end ultimately. But I don't think that we need that anymore, because we have this amazing moment of information availability and the ability to talk over the internet. And I think that right now is probably the best. It's the golden age of spirituality. It's the best time to be into spiritual things that there has ever been in the history of the world, because of the access to information on the internet. I mean, look, when I was first starting out learning about this stuff, there was, and this was in the 90s, there was no information out there. I mean, there was a tiny bit that web was just happening. I mean, you could get a few books at like you know, on Wicca and things like that.
Psychic Eye bookstore, you could go there and hit the occult section, and that's about it.
That's I actually applied to work there in San Diego as a teenager just to get. Yeah, does that was a bookstore chain, right?
Yeah, because my
sister worked there in Las Vegas.
Yeah, we grew up in Las Vegas. There. Yeah, and they had it. I also lived in LA for a while, and they had it in the Valley. So that was the go-to spot if you wanted to find out about occultism. That was it.
There you go. I mean, that was exactly it when I was growing up. You know, in San Diego, it was like that. I tried to go work at that bookstore,
So Jason, like that sounds, and as a teenager, you were into this. What was, like, how'd you get to that point? Was that like a family thing or was that? Okay.
I like that. No. That was a big no.
Well, you know, that's rare. You know, a 17-year-old wanting to work at that type of a place. Like, I guess it does happen, but it's a one in a million type of thing.
Well, I'm not sure I have a clear answer to that question other than I worked in bookstores throughout my adolescence. And I was just on a search for knowledge. And and outside of, you know, what I was getting in high school, which was, you know, just kind of the standard curriculum, you know, I really wanted to know. And And through that kind of just pure quest for knowledge, I came across the idea of the occult and magic. And first it was in kind of a, you know, like reading H.P. Lovecraft and, you know, reading fiction and things like this. Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I love D&D. I think D&D actually is a great, is something that people should play more of because it exercises the imagination and brings out the collaboration abilities. And I think D&D is one of the best things that kids can do. But anyways, that aside, I think that, but from that, I really, you know, and it was the beginning of the internet. There was kind of this, I was very immersed in the idea of hacking and the hacker ethos and the idea of applying the metaphors of hacking to reality. You know, that was very popular at the time, like the idea of reality hacking. And yeah, I was just reading all of this counterculture literature, and if you read enough counterculture literature, you come across the occult, and you come across the idea of, you know, at that time chaos magic was very, very popular. And I decided to just see if it actually worked, and it did. And from then it became an overwhelming obsession and no longer a counterculture thing at all. I mean, it very quickly went from this kind of punk rock stance to, because that's how I got it. The idea of like, oh, like you can do this to rebel against the system or whatever.
Right.
It very quickly went from there to realizing that no, this is actually not just a very deep spiritual tradition, but I mean, this is really what human beings have been engaged in since the dawn of history, is, you know, trying to, whether it's taking psychedelics or just trying to interact with the world and make meaning on their own terms, and interact with the spirit world. And we've been doing that in every single human culture since the dawn of history, with this tiny, you know, this tiny, tiny window of, you know, industrialization and pure materialist science that, you know, has discounted this idea. But, you know, we're in the tiny minority in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. You know, for me, there's a big difference personally to being attracted to magic and giving myself to it. There was a big gap between those two things. Like, I was initially attracted to it and joined an order and went through their initiatory process, and not until that process was complete did I even realize what I was doing. And
wow, what order was that, if you don't mind me asking?
The OTO.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
you went through the entire OTO.
Yeah, well, I went through all the way from Minerva to Fourth and PI.
Okay, so you did your Man of Earth.
Yeah, I did the whole Man of Earth triad. So,
very cool.
So after doing my Fourth, all the way through, I would hear these people in the order talking about their initiatory experiences. I took my first man, and it was the most mind-blowing thing that ever happened, and blah, blah. And I was just going through the initiations and, like, waiting for it to happen. Like, when's my fucking turn coming, you know? And PI and fourth degree is annihilation, and I went through and did my fourth.
and my whole life exploded. And I felt like a ghost. I would look in my closet and those weren't my clothes. And everything that I had gone to in the past for comfort and relief didn't give that to me anymore. And that's the point where I had to give in and go, oh shit, this is real. And it works. And I'm in it. It took me that long. Like, for you, what was the point of surrender for you?
Wow, that's an amazing story. I have never been a member of the OTO, okay. Although I've certainly been, you know, as I said, I've tried to investigate every single angle of magic that I could. Clearly, you know, the Hermetic tradition, certainly the Golden Dawn tradition of which Crowley is a part, you know, something that I've been fascinated for a long time, and I see the places I think where Crowley very clearly got things right, and then I can see places where he very clearly got things wrong.
Yep.
And I'm sure that I think the modern OTO would probably clearly agree with me. I think that they are really trying to be kind of post Crowley in a way.
Right.
If you probably have a much better view on that than I do. But the good thing about magic is that it's a continuum and it's an evolutionary process, and it certainly did not begin or end with Crowley.
No. It's gone way past that now.
Sure. And so I guess, but I guess that's not answering your question. The point of surrender, I think that by the time of my, by the, t- I think, let it's me hard, figure huh? out this. I mean, yeah, because it's a continuum, right?
Yeah.
But I think that after my first book came out when I was 23, it was called Generation Hex. Okay. And it was an anthology of writing of young people that were practicing magic. And I really... very shortly thereafter, I very much got in over my head with magic at the same time that I was 23. I was, you know, had become minorly infamous within the counterculture.
Yeah.
And I, as you imagine, as a young 23-year-old dude, that kind of went to my head a little bit. And I very much, very quickly, I think probably in the same way that I would imagine people who are in bands at that age who get some recognition kind of get carried away with themselves and kind of lose perspective a little bit. I very quickly got in, lost sense of myself a little bit, and then also just got way in over my head doing crazy occult stuff that I really should not have been doing, just trying to push it as far as I could possibly take it, and doing all kinds of Kenneth Grant type stuff I'm sure you're aware of.
Yeah.
And, you know, all this like working with the Cliff Hoth and things like this, and I got into a situation where I very easily, you know, I spent maybe 2 or 3 years where I very easily could have died many times over, you know,
wow,
because of things that I was doing. And I got myself into a situation with magic that I had to either get myself out of using magic or die, basically.
Wow.
Without putting too many specifics on it. And that, I think, was probably my real initiation. And that was a process probably from my early 20s till, you know, around, I guess, my Saturn return, you might say.
Yeah.
You know, and, but it was also just, it was, as you said, the idea of giving yourself to magic. I mean, the idea that I was not at all comfortable, even in writing my early books, I was not at all, you know, it was, it's a scary thing. It's a big thing to do that with your life.
Yeah.
You know? And that's not something that I'd become fully comfortable with or surrendered to at all, you know, in my early 20s, you know.
It encompassed everything, and I didn't realize it. Like I said, I was doing this work and basically unconscious of what I was about, and what I was even doing. And I don't know, in hindsight and looking back on it, like, I don't even know if that was the point at the time. Like, maybe that's the thing. Because it seemed to me like the people around me knew what was up, you know? And I always felt like maybe I don't. And then when that final thing happened, like, it shattered reality for me. It broke everything. And I was like forced to be in this position where, like, you're either not going to feel anything anymore or you're going to figure it out and put yourself back together. Wow. And it's hard, man. Like, even to this day, you know, I don't, like you said, it's a continuum. It's a continual process. So, you know, I'm still like, you said, I haven't fucking attained anything. I'm still trying to figure it out.
What do you think? What do you think prompted that experience outside of just the fact that it was the fourth degree?
You mean like prompted the experience? To be honest with you, I think that it came from inside of me at some point. I think that going through those initiations are, it's just a way of, like, you would work a computer program almost, like code. And then when you hit enter and the program is being run, now it's, the routine is going to run out. Do you know what I'm saying? It's going to happen.
Yeah.
So you go through those steps, like, that's what's going to happen at the end of those steps. And I always wondered, as I was going through, at the efficacy of the initiatory process. And when it was done, there was no more wonder about its efficacy. Like, okay, this did something, you know, this worked. It did what it was supposed to do. And now I'm here, and it's kind of like, be careful what you wish for. You know, I don't know if that answers the question, but I think it's like running the computer program is the thing that was the driver for that.
Wow. Well, this is maybe a good, actually, this is maybe a good place to seg into. So I have this book coming out.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about that too. Sorry.
So which directly relates to what we're talking about, right?
Cool.
So the name of the book is John Dee and the Empire of Angels. And it comes out on April 17th, and it's a 560-page hardback that is basically the complete story of Enochian magic. And when I say Enochian magic, that really does mean the Western magical tradition for the last 500 years.
Not just so, angelic stuff.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Because it puts together the first two-thirds of the book are a biography of John Dee, Queen Elizabeth's court astrologer, who channeled this thing called the Enochian magical system with Edward Kelly, which was, you know, the most, as you, I'm sure you know, probably the most elaborate computer program, if you will, for changing human consciousness or magical system that the world has probably ever seen.
Yeah.
With the potential exception of maybe some of the more complex of Vajrayana Buddhist stuff, but maybe even then. And then the last third of the book is about how the Enochian system resonated throughout history, and it's not only created things like, in some sense, the British Empire and the American Empire, but was the core of Rosicrucianism and Freemasonry, and then the Golden Dawn. Of course, it was the core material of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and then from there into Crowley and Thelema, and then even past then into things like witchcraft and Satanism and things like that. But I think that so I spend a lot of time in that book talking about Crowley's work in the Aethers with Victor Neuberg in Algeria in 1907, and looking at Crowley's assessment of Enochian magic. And then also I talk a lot about Jack Parsons afterwards. And one of the things that I really wanted to do that book mostly for myself, because this stuff is just so complex.
Very heady.
It's really hard to get your head around, right?
Because
on one end you've got, of course, the original D material, which is all about angels and Christ and all this. And then you look at the Crowley stuff, and it's all about, you know, Babylon and Crowley talk and Golden Dawn concepts and things like that. And then you've got Jack Parsons declaring himself the Antichrist and all this. And you just look at this and it's just like, how do I reconcile all this? This is so complex. It's like what's going on here, you know? And so this book is really I didn't do anything for basically, I spent three years of every waking moment just putting the story back together. And
where
that's
do you
what I
hope. Start with something like that? Like that, like you said, it's so big. Like that's Enochian stuff. Like as a quote unquote magician, when just touching on that, I'm like, oh gosh, that's that's a lot, man. Like making tablets and tables and beeswax, you know, sigils and Jesus Christ, are you serious? Like, where do you even start?
Yeah, no, yeah, that I did all that. It takes a long time.
So you started with practice.
Yeah. No, I started with practice like I think 15 years ago. I think that, well, okay, the short answer is when you read the book, you'll have it gives you a much simpler handle on it once you get through it. I mean, it is very complex, but once you get through it and you see the big picture and the context, it makes a lot more sense. And I think that the first key is to understand that Enochian really is the Western magical tradition, right? Because it comes out of D, and then when you get the Golden Dawn, really what the Golden Dawn was a bunch of conceptual layers laid out on top of Enochian. So they took the Enochian tablets and then they put Kabbalah on top of them and then Tarot on top of that, and then they added all this Egyptian stuff in and Hebrew and things like that. And then so when people went through the Golden Dawn, what they were really getting, in my perspective, is kind of training wheel exercises prior to assessing Enochian.
Oh wow. It's like I see like cobblestone, like putting together these disparate pieces to make one thing to help you get somewhere.
Right, totally.
Yeah.
And Crowley took that and he really took the Enochian on. And when then in 1907 he went to Algeria with his lover Victor Neuberg, and together they spent a month walking across the desert, probably taking something like mescaline, going through the Enochian system, ascrying the 30 aethers. And the key to understanding Crowley is to understand that it was from that experience, much more in some ways than the Book of the Law. He had, you know, he'd gotten the Book of the Law, but it was when he went through the Enochian aethers, that's where the quote unquote religion of Thelema really comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that's kind of what he was trying to express in, you know, obviously we can't talk about OTO secrets, but what he was trying to express in things like the Gnostic Mass and some of the, you know, the magical system that he then expressed was really what he was getting from the aethers. And the core of the aethers, and I say this very clearly in the book, and of Enochian in general, whether it's D or Golden Dawn or Crowley, is basically exactly what you just said. It's the destruction of the individual ego. That's what Enochian does to some extent, right? In Kabbalistic language, you are annihilated into Bina, right?
Right.
But the whole point of Enochian is to annihilate the individual, the individual's false constructed sense of themselves, because we all, as we go through life, build up this this story about who we are, and this kind of we make up a story about who we are, and then we try to convince other people that it's real,
putting on different masks and taking parts of other people's personalities and cobbling that together to make this thing that isn't anything in reality.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you could argue that we kind of have to, because it's a survival mechanism. We're trying to, when we're growing up, we build that in order to relate with the tribe and relate with people around us.
Right.
But ultimately, as a spiritual aspirant, you have to come to the realization that not only is it not real, but it's like a layer of black paint on the window in between you and what is really there, right? Yeah. Because it's the ape of Thoth, as they say. Yeah. So So the, you know, I think anyone who's had a high octane psychedelic experience, you know, particularly on the more potent psychedelics, will probably know exactly what I'm talking about, where you do get the ego flattening and the erasure of personal identity. And that's, by the way, it is a critical experience on the spiritual path, but it's certainly not the one that people should start with.
Right.
It's, you know, it's something that comes, you know, in down much, you know, maybe a decade or two into your spiritual path. It's not necessarily, you know, in the 60s, people had this idea that they had to take, 800 milligrams of acid and delete their ego, or they were not enlightened.
Good luck.
Doesn't have to be that macho.
Yeah. You know, Dee and Kelly, like, the two of them were famous and infamous back in the day, right? Like, Kelly was kind of a drunk. Is that true?
Yeah, he was an alcoholic. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so one of them would have the vision and the other one would scry. Is that correct? Or write it down.
That's exactly correct.
So and, everything is came from the two of them, and they actually came out with the Enochian language, like the angelic language that was from Eden, supposedly, correct? Is that correct?
That's right.
And I mean, I wonder even now, like, is that just two guys in a room making shit up so that they can have the favor of the queen, or you know what I'm saying, or not?
Well, if they did it to get the favor of the queen, it didn't work very well, because they were basically progressively outcast and exiled shit. From court, and, you know, financially destitute the entire time they were doing the sessions. So there was no clear, although they were very much trying to get the attention of European monarchs like Rudolf II. But yeah, I mean, Dee at this time was in his early 50s, and he was, you know, probably the most storied scientist or proto-scientist, you might say, of England at this time. He was a government advisor to Elizabeth, and had spent his academic career helping to build the British intelligence services. He had been proselytizing for the idea of New World colonization and that there should be a British Empire. And he'd also spent a lot of his career studying the occult and going on missions around Europe to procure rare occult texts, often for the intelligence services, because they thought that they could use them to do things like remote viewing and spying and things like this.
Wow.
But he himself, Dee, really, you have to think of, he was like an IT guy, you know, or an academic. Okay. He was very much a book learning head kind of guy. And so he had been interested in the occult for his whole life, but he'd never really been able to get it to work, as it were, meaning that he had often tried scrying. And scrying is, you know, you might consider the, you know, the psychedelics of the day. It was scrying is just taking a small piece of crystal or maybe a crystal ball and basically staring at it with a candle next to it, staring at it until you kind of trance out and start to see things either in the crystal ball or in your own head. Right.
Right.
It's like a self-hypnosis. But he'd never been able to get it to work because he was so, like, hyper-rational. And, of course, you know, things like going into trance states can be very easy for people with a psychic bent or people who are much more artistic or much more intuitive or emotional or in their feelings. For them, it can be very, very easy, people who are at home with associative thought. But for people who are compulsionally rational and are often constantly second-guessing themselves, or disbelieving it, it can be very, very difficult, right? Because they can't get out of the discursive, rational mind, or just are not comfortable doing that.
Right.
So what happened was that it wasn't until his 50s that Dee hooked up with this guy, Edward Kelly, who was, yes, an alcoholic. He was kind of a con man. He was a drifter. He'd had his ears cut off for forging coins, potentially. He'd been accused of necromancy and trying to summon demons and summon corpses out of graveyards. And, you know, that, at least that's what people said about him. And he was this very disreputable character, whereas Dee was of high society and had a very good reputation and had risen through the ranks. Kelly was, you know, basically a hobo, right? You know,
like the anti-D.
yeah, I mean, he was from the wrong side of the tracks, but he could do it. He could scry. And so what happened is they formed this working relationship. Because D, by the way, had actually, he kind of had like talent scouts who would look for scryers for him.
Wow.
From court, and they found Kelly. And they formed this relationship over about 7 years where, yes, it's exactly as you said, D would do these magical rituals, which mostly consisted of prayer and asking God and the angels to send higher wisdom. And then Kelly would go into the scrying trance and report what he was seeing. And D would write down the material. And then, so over about 7 years of that working relationship, they basically transmitted the Enochian system, including the Enochian watchtowers and the Enochian temple furniture, the sigillum and all that stuff.
Wow.
And also the Enochian language, which, you know, they was purported to be supposedly the language spoken by angels and by humanity before the fall from Eden. And that you could use that language to magically manipulate reality.
And I mean, that language has grammar and syntax they've found, isn't that right?
Well, so Donald Laycock, who was an Australian, Crowley claimed it had grammar and syntax.
Okay.
But Donald Laycock, who was an Australian linguist who made his career, was not a magic person, was not a believer by any means. But who had had this, made his career studying very strange languages, or excuse me, not strange, but languages that are not often studied, with very complex structures like Urdu and a bunch, I think Phoenician and a bunch of other, you know, not very commonly studied languages, decided to study Enochian. And he came to the conclusion that, what did he say? He said that a lot of the early Enochian that Kelly is giving is probably just transglossolalia, meaning he's just spouting stuff.
Right.
But that a lot of the later Enochian, he did think it had structure. It didn't quite have a... He said that the grammar and syntax that it has is English. So it's not that different from English, which suggests that somebody who knew English was making up words. However... he also came to the conclusion that it did have very inexplicable features like repeating root words and I think morphemes and things like that, that he could not explain at all. It didn't make sense that somebody would just make something up that had that type of an internally consistent structure. And so the conclusion that he came to was that the jury was out. He could not say one way or another if it was real. And the main reason was because there are so few words in Enochian. I mean, when you total them up, I think it's only a few hundred words wherever transmitted.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not enough to make a clear study of it. But he basically says it's down to the gematria, where he says that, you know, the test of it is that if people, future channelers, were in theory to channel more Enochian, if it matched the structure of the original Enochian, and if it had the same, if it matched the mathematical internal consistency, and if a gematria was proper gematria was transmitted and made sense, and so he basically says the jury's out on it, which I thought is, you know, an interesting at least conclusion for, you know, a professional mainstream linguist to come to.
That's like crazy, and it's strange, peculiar, like. It became more, as they were marinating in whatever they were doing, it got more complex, you know, and more was coming out of it. It got harder to debunk, it seems like.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that as somebody has, I'm guessing, had experience of occult rituals and things like that, I mean, you really, you know, you can clearly, if you've gone through those experiences, I think you have a better grasp on probably what was happening, where I think that people... when they do quote unquote magic rituals, often it really is there's an element of self hypnosis, and they're trying to get themselves into a certain state with you know, ritual, or, you know, set and setting, as Timothy Leary put it, you know, putting themselves in a heightened ritual environment and then potentially taking some type of consciousness altering substance. And, you know, there's a theater aspect to it where they're really trying to vibe themselves up and almost to get past themselves and kind of believe something. And actually, that becomes much easier if you're doing it in a group, because then it becomes the, kind of, there's kind of like a social pressure almost to, yeah, to have an experience.
Trick yourself into becoming a conduit. Yep.
Exactly. But as I'm sure you know, you know, people can go into those experiences even cynical or with a sarcastic attitude, as I did when I first started doing them, you know, trying to debunk even, or, you know, or not convinced that it's real. And then, you know, as we say in chaos magic, they kind of fake it till they make it. And at some point it clicks, you know, and all of a sudden it's real.
So I got a question for you, and this is totally selfish question, but since I got you here, I'm going to take advantage of the opportunity. This is something that I've wondered, and it's something that happened recently with the Psychic Bible that has happened throughout my life, and I want to know what your opinion is on it. So, like, certain books or a song, mostly books though, have a way of coming to life. And what I mean by that is, like, you're having experiences in your life and, you know, you're doing your thing and going along on your way, and you'll pick up a book and that book is speaking directly to you right where you're at that moment. And I found with occult books, a lot of Crowley stuff and others, that they'll change over time. So they meet you where you're at the moment. But with this, the Psychic Bible, like, everything that I was trying to put together in my head that I couldn't quite gel, it just wasn't coming together in the right way. When the first two chapters I opened it up, I was like, holy shit, somebody already did this for me and is speaking it for me. Like, put it together. What do you think that is, that when something comes alive like that?
Well, I mean, thank you. That's a huge, huge compliment in terms of the Psychic Bible.
Thank you.
That's certainly not that's certainly not something I would have been thinking, just writing, you know, maybe the introduction, you know, putting that book together like on a laptop in a Starbucks in, yeah, you know, suburban Vancouver at the time. But I think that, okay, so I absolutely know what you're talking about. I certainly think that Crowley's books are very much like that, and they do change. They seem to be alive and change over time. And you get something new every time you read them. I think the I Ching is very much like that. So yeah. I think that if people are... So, and by the way, if you're listening to this and you're very understandably skeptical of this whole world, as you well should be, because there's a lot to be skeptical of, or you're just curious about interacting with it in some way, I mean, the one thing that I do recommend, and actually the thing that got me into this and kind of convinced me a little bit out of my hard-headed rationalist skeptic worldview, is the I Ching, and consulting the I Ching, which is, you know, the oldest book in the world. It's a divination book that you can consult by throwing coins. It's from China in, I think, 5,000 years ago. So that's, you know, very much a live book. It very much feels like talking to a living intelligence. As to why that happens, I have no idea, man. I don't know.
It's the strangest thing, man. And it happens. It seems to happen always at the right moment, and it's just crazy. I don't know. It's one of the wonders of being into this whole thing that I love so much. You know, there's a lot too. I can't wait to read the new book, dude. I really can't.
Thank you.
So before we take off, where can people find you online and all that? Where can we get a hold of this?
Okay. Well, the best place to find me online is just jasonlouv.com. And that has archived all of my many incarnations and projects. You can find my books there. You can find all my blogs, and there's tons of podcasts to go through. And there's also my occult school, which is magic.me. Where I have, you know, video trainings and all of this stuff. In terms of the new book, the best place, you can find it on Amazon. It's just John Dee and the Empire of Angels, or go to johndee007.com, where I have lots more information about the book. And the book comes out April 17th. I just got my first copy yesterday. It's beautiful, I have to say, with small, you know, which we have to thank the publisher for. But I say with no bias, of course. But the one thing I will say is the publisher has informed me that they've already gone through their orders for the first print run. That's the orders from the distributors, meaning Amazon and Barnes and Noble. So what that probably means, there's been more demand than they expected. So what that probably means is the first print run is going to sell out right away. So I am recommending, if you are interested, to pre-order on Amazon, where it's actually on sale right now also. Pre-order so that you get your copy right away, because as we know with hardcover occult books, they get snapped up by secondhand collectors, and they go up in price a lot. I mean, I think people are selling the Psychic Bible now for like, I saw $1,800 on Amazon.
I saw $2,700 the other day on
eBay. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course I've seen that money, right?
Yeah, right?
I wonder if anyone actually paid that much for it. That's
crazy. It was signed by Jen.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
That's intense, though. Like, oh, man. Maybe I should get my copy out of storage or something.
Yeah.
Anyways, it's likely that the first edition of this will sell quickly and then go up in value. So I'm just recommending to pre-order. And so it's jasonlouv.com and then johnd007.com. And then I have a free, if you are interested in magic, I do have a free email course on it. Which is just a week-long course that is full of podcasts and videos and instructional material. And you can get that for free. You just text the word shaman to the phone number 44222.
Wow. Very cool. You know, one of the things I heard you say, I think it was on Duncan's show, was, you know, back in history, all these traditions presupposed a lot of time left for the human race. And you know, they very slowly brought you in, and we don't have that much time anymore. It doesn't seem like we have much time if we don't get our shit together.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. And I think that's why these things are set. There's suddenly so much demand, and people are so interested in these things because unfortunately we're not really getting a whole lot of answers from certainly the supposed authorities, you know, like, you know, it's, I think that everyone gets to a point as they grow up where they realize there are no adults.
You know? Yeah.
And all
I
you
gotta
have to
figure
do is
this
look
shit
at,
out. Oh no.
Yeah. Well, you know, so, but also I think that in looking back at many of these prior spiritual traditions, we have these immense reservoirs of wisdom to draw on of people who have lived the life and come up with solutions of the solutions that are not like here, take this pill, but that are, you know, ways to do your life.
Workable systems. Yeah.
Yeah. And at the same time, a lot of these systems, as you said, you know, you look at something like Mahayana Buddhism, or, you know, where they're assuming that you'll be able to reincarnate ad infinitum on the same planet. And, you know, take, for instance, the Bodhisattva value, where you continue to reincarnate until all beings on Earth are liberated. Well, yeah. That might have made sense when there were 250 million people on the planet, but there will very soon be 9 billion. And we're losing, the ice caps are almost gone, and the oceans are acidified, and the rainforests are almost gone. And every baby born on the planet now, before they take their first breath, has over 250 toxins or Jesus plastic breakdowns in their bloodstream. And we unfortunately live in a culture where this is happening, not only happening far faster than anyone even suspected when they first became aware of things like global warming. It's happening much faster than they thought it would. But at the same time, we live in a culture where we're encouraged to anesthetize ourselves, and we're offered, you know, any type of entertainment you want, whether it's Netflix binging or Twitch streaming or video games or whatever it happens to be, you know, pick your poison. It's all offer. It's all on offer, either online or out in the world.
It's a psychic war.
It is. And I think that the war is, and since you have this background, I'll just put it in this context. The war really is of the human consciousness against Karanzon.
Oh shit! You know,
and
yeah,
Karanzon meaning the dispersion of and distraction of the fragmented mind with no wisdom or understanding, and that's something that I bring out very clearly in this book, both how we got here, and potentially the way through. We live in an almost, you know, almost completely Karanzonic world now, where people are unable to carry one train of thought from one second to the next. And unable to focus, and they're offered endless distraction and dispersion, and the great gift of magic, I think, is not only having a toolkit for contextualizing and understanding that, but having a toolkit to turn yourself almost into, you know, be a superhero, you know, go for it.
Hell yeah, man. And there's other people out there that are doing it too, and you're not alone. That's
very exciting.
That's beautiful.
That's why I think this is the golden age of magic, you know, because we can all talk about this openly. For, I think, by the way, the first time in history, this is probably the first time in history where you could just talk about stuff like this openly without thinking someone was going to burn you at the stake.
God, it feels so good. So, thank God. Yeah. Right on, man. Jason, I appreciate you taking the time with us today. You're welcome here with us anytime you want, man. Like,
thank you
so much. And
yeah, thank you for having me on. It was a great conversation and a great honor, and hope your podcast goes great for you.
And this has been a great education for me. This is Apple talking. Aaron, since he started reading your book and talking a lot more about you lately, I've just seen kind of an awakening in him, and the way you're approaching this, I'm looking very forward to reading your material. And I just want to thank you, because obviously we all need to be preparing for what's coming ahead of us, and it seems like you've kind of deconstructed it, reconstructed it to where I think I can get a better handle on
thanks,
it now.
Jason.
To prepare.
Thank you very much.
To prepare for what's ahead of us, man. It's crazy times.
And what's
you so
here
much.
Right now.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amen. Right.
Yeah, it's not ahead of us anymore. We are in
we
the future.
Up.
I mean,
yeah, we caught up to ourselves finally. All right, man.
I mean, you mentioned CRISPR. I mean, think about this. You can now order, anyone can order a DIY CRISPR kit off eBay. That's the future we live in.
Okay. So. I didn't know that. That's crazy.
I'll leave you with that.
All right. All right, buddy. You have a great day, man.
All right.
Be
thanks.
Well.
Thank you,
Jason.
All.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you later. Bye.
That was Jason Louvre, everybody, and I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as we did. It's really amazing to hear that stuff laid out like that in such a, I don't know how to even articulate it, in such a way that it makes it understandable and approachable. I know that for me, one of the things with magic and all of that's contained in it is that a lot of it seems really hard to understand, and having somebody out there like Jason that can break it down so that, you know, you don't have to have a classical education in the Elizabethan era to understand what the hell is going on is really, really a cool thing. So Jason, we're honored to have you on the show, and I really appreciate it, man. So yeah, follow us on Instagram and leave us reviews on iTunes. Go over to the website, sign up for the newsletter, and check out all the stuff there. Remember to hashtag your post on Instagram with hashtag No Simple Road so that you can show up on the family tab and we can get to know each other. And also the Patreon, patreon.com/No Simple Road. Guys, this is just me by myself out here. Everybody else is in the house, and I'm asking you, you know, help me get there, man. Help all of us get there to where we're doing this full time and we can give more of our time and creativity and energy to No Simple Road and to you guys. I know that it's a strange thing sometimes when I get some of the feedback that I get from you and I read it and I just think, man, it's, you know, it's just us sitting out there on the porch and it's doing stuff for people. And to know that is really humbling and mind blowing. And just know that inside of me, where I'm at right now in my life, that's all I want, is to be able to do more of this and to provide that thing for you guys all the time and for us. Because believe it or not, we're getting the same thing that you are, and it's making us feel included and connected and a part of. And if we can do that more in this world the way things are today, then we're winning. And so together we're going to make it happen. And just remember, man, we all love you guys. And that's it. So go out and enjoy the rest of your week. Tell a friend about the show and all the other stuff I already said a million times. And from everybody here at No Simple Road, we love you guys. And we'll see you next week for an interview with the Higgs. So yeah, if you haven't checked them out, check them out. Peace. Be well.
Osiris.
This podcast is in the loop. The Legion of Osiris Podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com.